Perverting of his childhood innocence is a theme in Back to the Future that I think goes unnoticed by most people, but it's pretty sick, actually. I've seen like a vague allusion to it on a few threads, but I don't think anyone has really nailed this one to its full capacity. So you guys might have heard this before. When Marty McFly is laying in his bed, he is sort of wrapped up in his suspenders, and he's laying down in a really sexually suggestive way, and the suspenders are kind
absolutely,
of
absolutely.
Okay, so this has been referenced to by a few different people. I've heard it scattered across the internet, and so the idea is that Marty's laying in bed in this sexually suggestive pose, and he's got his suspenders wrapped pretty much like around his thighs, almost like he's in bondage, and the idea is he's a teenage high school boy, and that the producers or directors put him in this position as like a subliminal message about like Hollywood rape of young actors or whatever the heck it's supposed to mean. But I feel like there's more to that specifically with this movie. So not only is he in this strange position, but he is awoken from this position to a absolutely crazy old man calling him in the middle of the night, telling him to come over basically. And
like
what
a
else?
Booty call?
Basic, really. I mean, that's what happens. You know, this is a high school boy, and an old man calls him in the middle of the night and says, "Come over." And what else does he say? He says, "Oh, by the way, bring the video camera."
Whoa,
so it's pretty gross, but it gets really weird. Not just because you brought up the idea of the, you know, perversion of the childhood innocence, and actually the scene that you're referring to about him reemerging into his new family life and the perversion of his innocence in that sense happens when he wakes up from that pose after the whole movie, you know, is over. He wakes up from that pose in his bed and walks into the living room, and that's where you witness this new life that he's in, where you claim that it's not his new life, it's a perversion of his life. But the sick part about the whole thing is that so he's laying in his bed in that position where they're saying he was you know, it's suggested that he sexually abused as a child. Well, in Back to the Future 2, when he re-enters that room, he jumps back into his bed. But obviously, it's a different time frame, you know, a tangent timeline. So it's not really his bed. He jumps into the bed of two little kids, and there's Michael Jackson posters all over the wall, and the kids start screaming rape in this scene. So
yeah, okay.
So you have to the kids are screaming, and you have to pause it and watch it a couple times, but they're screaming rape. And so you have him laying in his bed like this. You have this old creepy guy calling him, and I say, "Come over at 1 a.m, bring the video camera." And then you have him, when he crawls back into that bed later in the film, you have this, you know, this incident happen where, you know, you have these kids yelling, these little kids crying out, "Rape, rape, rape." And those are the only times that he's in this bed in the film. It's mind-blowing, to say the least. So I like that you touched on that as like a perversion of his childhood innocence. And that touches also loosely along the lines of this, you know, him falling in love with his mother or his mother falling in love with him. It's all kind of creepy in that sense. So anyways, there you have it.
You know, I take the end of that first one and the beginning of the second one is kind of a statement on consumerism in general, and just that you have this place of all possibilities, and that the future, like when he goes back to the future, literally it could be anything, really, you know, because if you change one thing in the past, you know, butterfly effect or whatever, could be anything in the future. And what do you see but, you know, just the epitome of, you know, you got a giant fucking SUV type truck, right? Four-wheel drive. if I recall correctly, isn't that the deal? He's in like the driveway, and there's just this big truck. I mean, it's been a while.
No, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. I just see it as like just more just an increase of the same of basically people being too big for their britches. Like him at the very beginning of the film when he's got that giant fucking speaker and it blows him away. It's like turning everything up to 11, and just it turning into a very destructive force that just it's too much for it to handle and it just explodes. And that consumer society is like a representation of that same principle where you have people living beyond their means. And then in the end, it's not really gonna, they can't do that. They can't, sustain that way, in the long run. And, kind of a reflection of that. And also kind of a joke on the whole deal, because when you look at the future and it's like everything just increased, what do you see? But like just the epitome of like American consumerism just perpetuating on into just continuing like that, which I have a hard time buying in the long run, you know, but that's probably my own pessimism or something. I don't know.
Go ahead. Please.
Yeah, no, I just really quickly tying that back into like the beginning of the discussion where we're like, okay, if we're gonna manifest a reality, how far can we take that? Can we just completely get enough people to think of something that has absolutely no precedent or any kind of hint of a reality and then bring it about? Or do we have to take these issues with a certain amount of maturity and understanding that there's only ways to change reality or interface with reality? So like this idea that, to get back to like materialism, that growth can continue forever. Well, that's not true. I mean, enough growth, you're going to have collapse. So this whole idea of, if we believe in the growth of the economy enough, I mean, that is a almost cultish belief system, but I don't think there's any transcending that. I think that ultimately that just leads to breakdown, and that might lead to change, and that might be part of that cycle. But again, just getting back to that idea of, you know, how far can we take these ideas, and can we just like really just believe something so much that it's going to happen? I don't necessarily think that's the case, because I think there's a distinction between all levels of reality, and unfortunately we're in a classical Newtonian reality in a lot of ways. And while, you know, some types of quantum effects and other kind of weird shit happens that hints at a deeper continuum or a deeper synchronicity to things, I think there's bounds of reason to all these ideas. And so I just, that's why I'm always trying to like keep myself in check when I'm going too far with some hypotheses. But anyway, you were going to say something, David, or Alan, go ahead.
No, I was exactly, you hit it. That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. That this came full circle, because what if we can manifest, it's like, you know, you get it's almost like the time travel is like, and this intelligence is very much the classic idea of the djinn, right? Like, you know, the genie in the bottle. So, Joe, you talk about bottling the power of love. You know, if love is, it's almost like, you know, cosmic stem cells, right? Like we can make anything out of this. You know, this is, it's like you could put that intelligence in a bottle. It means you could make anything you want. But is it, I'm wondering if it's not so much that there's something wrong with that idea as much as it is we've been so limited in our imagination that, like, we could make the world anything we want. And instead of making a world of, like, world peace and, you know, whatever, we're essentially, I mean, is Marty McFly any better than Biff going, yeah, I'll make myself rich? You know, he's not to the same extreme, but he basically did the same thing. So it's, you know, something like that. Like, is it an issue with them, the idea of manifestation and trying to bottle this? Or is it like, again, is that inherently flawed? Or are we so ignorant and unimaginative that all we can think of is like, I'd have a really cool car?
Uh-huh. He's like a Marty McFly on shit.
And it's like that whole secret law. Yeah. Yeah. It's the law of attraction You know, what is that movie, The Secret, they say, like, oh, and you can manifest your reality, and if you picture this sports car, you'll get it. Like, that's literally what is in that Secret movie. You could mm-hmm. You could manifest a sports car, and that's basically what Marty McFly does.
Yeah. Yeah, and it speaks to, like, where does life satisfaction come from? Is it just owning this, owning that, having the biggest toy, or is it like this? Is it knowledge that brings about inner peace and like inner appreciation of life and your place in it, regardless of what you have or don't have? And so I think there's a lot of ways to engage with this kind of thinking system where it can be either extremely narcissistic, or you can think of yourself as part of a larger continuum. And it's like, okay, well, how can I make use of this knowledge to be of service to like other people and be of service to evolving? If we think that we're part of evolution, we have a co-creative process in evolution, what are we doing to contribute to that co-evolution? Are we just sitting in the dark watching Lady Gaga just like, oh, that's neat, and then you know I don't know, it's like, what are we using that for? So that's
actually
always my
exactly what David and I do.
Yeah. And no, you know what? No, and that's not even the problem. It's just like, you guys speak to a much like deeper appreciation of that information, and you tie it into other subjects, whereas other people, I think, stay fixated on very narrow or very superficial aspects of it that they never get into. Okay, well, how can we use this information? Then where else do we see it? And how does this apply to our lives? You know, how can we use this to like lead a better life or this and that? And I think a lot of times that doesn't come up. It's still kind of an external pursuit. It's not a path to inner development for a lot of people. And maybe I'm wrong, but I see that.
Totally.
And of course, we need to ask, you know, are we any better? Like, we might say, oh.
Oh, sure.
Right, you know, I think it's always important to be like, wait, am I a fucking hypocrite?
Well, that goes without saying. I mean, right. Of course we are. But even so.
Yeah. I mean, the Zohar is pretty loaded with examples where it's like, it's describing how one can have the sense that they're moving forward or that they're evolving or that they're developing when in fact they're doing just the opposite, because they're relating to what's in the mirror and not what's looking into the mirror. And that when you're just completely fixated on the external representation of the thing, that if you're not getting the meaning of what everything's pointing to, or recognizing how things that are external can be a manipulation or a, you know, you keep using the word perverted, but a perverted kind of model of what it is that's actually real, that's not following the same order, that can, certain things that are looked at as growth are actually a hindrance the whole time, but can maintain the illusion of growth. And so genies, or the golem, or all these kind of things can express themselves in that way, where something's destructive but it's presenting itself as progress. And so I also feel that the atomic bomb is like the highest example of that principle, where you're looking at something that's absolutely devastating and you're looking at it with awe. And so, you know, when you look at Oppenheimer's words about it, and you know, I am become death and this and that, and a thousand suns or whatever it was that he said, you know, it's kind of like, well, how glorious is your destruction, you know?
Right, shock and awe.
Right, and that's not the Shakina. That's its, you know, kind of external perverted representation.
Right, and then of course we have the idea of like atomic energy that like, well, hey, we can use this for good. I just, while I'm thinking of it, I mean, I just do want to point out, I know this has been covered, but I mean, this was so many episodes back. Two things. One, we have the famous quote from Einstein is like, I would have become a watchmaker. Right? So the connection to the clock, but also Oppenheimer, when he says, I am become death. If you look at any modern translations of the Bhagavad Gita, the more literal translation would be, I am become time.
Yeah.
So, like, this is why I'm saying, like, this connection, this to me is so clear in my mind that there's this really heavy connection here. It's like, we split the Adam, and it's like, oh, now we're becoming in time, or are we, like, fracturing time, or however you want to, you know, view that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the thing that comes to my mind immediately looking at, you know, one of the last times we had you, Joe, on, I should speak about you in the third person, but when we're talking about, you know, you're looking at Malkut Yesod and Netzach and Hod as the flux capacitor, and I have this kind of, I'm kind of blown away, I'm surprised it's not, people are more familiar with this, but with the old correspondences of the tree prior to the European version, you know, you have Yesod is Jupiter and Malkut is Saturn. And so Saturn and Earth are taken to be energetically one in a sense because the Earth is ruled by time. But that you have, you know, this something that's supposed to be an exile, and what's an exile is us. And then we're because of that, the Klippot rush in. But then it's all veiled, the fact that we are, what is time? And that time isn't ultimately linear. That's the thing, is like the Malkut is like a queen on a chessboard. She can move any way. She's supposed to rise up the tree and reconnect with her corollary. But, you know, you get what I'm driving at here. It's really interesting, especially in terms of Back to the Future, because you're acknowledging that something that we're taking as linear, and this is the paradigm we exist within, where everything is fixed and kind of rigid, is actually something very loose and flexible or malleable. And so this seems to be the meaning of the flux capacitor in the first place, is that we're just pushing everything down to one level when really it's the thing that we're repressing is something that should be spread throughout the entirety, and reconciling the things that have distanced themselves from other aspects of themselves.
Yeah, that's heavy.
why do you use that word? Is there something wrong with the gravity?
Oh, Lord.
And Alan, just to speak of time splitting, there's a term called bifurcation points. In complex systems where there's a fluctuation at some point, where again, where you have this period of symmetry or this period of non-change, and then it reaches this kind of imbalance, then there's some kind of event or fluctuation or some kind of stress that then creates a split. So you seem to be speaking of like time splitting in kind of like almost an intuitive or just kind of an analogous sense. But there again is like kind of a literal thing that can happen, does happen, and when you think of the universe as a complex system, these things are happening all the time. And so in our little microcosmos, that definitely indicates kind of like a bifurcation point of sorts. And so that little picture I linked, that's just kind of a crude diagram of what they look like. But you can almost think of like the branching of the world, just expand that exponentially, and you have all these like splittings and periods of chaos interlinked with little split points of periodicity, and it's just interesting and
right
to visualize that way.
This is exactly what Doc Brown draws in Back to the Future 2.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, basically, it's a split timeline, right? Like,
right.
Oh,
yeah.
You know, we went back. You know, Biff went back in time, created this alternate, blah blah blah.
And there's always like argument about, okay, is time real? Is it just something that we invent? And the formulas of, or the mathematics of physics say that time isn't real because the laws are called, they're called time invariant. So if you reverse the direction of an event, you can return back to the beginning point. But thermodynamics contradicts that point, where time is a very literal effect and is a very literal real thing, and that you can't reverse a complex system and arrive back at the original conditions. So I tend to lean that time is a real thing, but that it loops in and on itself a lot, so that we arrive at points that are similar to what we once were at, but is not the same thing. So it's endless novelty. It's an endless creative process that we're part of, and to be part of that and just to like kind of flow with it and have fun with it. You know, I kind of like see that as almost the point of life, really.
Right. I mean, what we're speaking to here isn't necessarily like, if you're speaking to transcending time, you're not saying that time ceases to be. It's just that there's something that's basically caught up in something that it goes on. It's like the end of the never-ending story, not the movie, but the second half of the book, where it's like the thing, why it's a never-ending story, because it goes on, and then there's a transcendence from an aspect of it that goes beyond it and can make changes from beyond it.
Roads don't cease, but where we're going, we don't need roads.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Pathways don't stop. The pathways don't go away.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you're just not being kind of ruled by them, I guess. So was the DeLorean it wasn't four-wheel drive, obviously, so was it it was the back wheels?
Oh, I have no idea.
I just wanted to tie it back with Fulcrum's Pendulum, because that's kind of, I was like, when you're describing the car, I'm just like,
okay, you want to tie it back to Fulcrum's Pendulum, so let's go back to this thing where Wolfgang Pauli goes to Carl Jung with these repeating dreams, and the oscillation symbolism, Wolfgang Pauli's dreams, and the relativity of psychic time. We know that Wolfgang Pauli's dreams point in this direction. In a letter written in the year 1938, he wrote that his anima, in Jungian psychology, the bridge to yet unknown creative ideas in the collective unconscious, manifests her conception of time with the assistance of, quote, odd oscillation symbols. That belong to the same category of periodic symbols as, quote, the light and dark stripes, and, quote, the pendulum and the little men from earlier material. As the preceding letter shows, the latter relates to his so-called world clock vision of 1932, which Jung had interpreted and published in 1936. But in the year 1950, Pauli discerned that Jung's interpretation was unsatisfactory. This world clock vision generated in Pauli a sense of sublime harmony, which shows that its content, understood on a psychophysical level, would have been the solution of the oscillation problem of Paul's anima. And then the guy's comment here is, I propose that Wolfgang Pauli here calls the anima is in fact the anima mundi, the world soul, or exactly the potential state of the world soul, in which he is in an excited state and ready to give birth to a, quote, child, i.e. ready for an incarnation out of what the unus mundus into our space and time bound world. Such a process is observable as what I call a singular quantum leap or a singular radioactive decay on the psychophysical level, i.e. observable as a spontaneous event in the outside or the inside. Since such singular events happen spontaneously in space and time, they are, however, not observable with the help of the physical element planned by will in this way. Okay, sorry, this is where it's kind of breaking down. But it says, this is why symbolism of oscillations, frequencies, rhythms, spectrums, light and dark stripes, along with his phobia of wasps, pursued him even until the end of his life. Therefore, we find countless references to this sort of dream in his correspondence. So again, just this idea of the pendulum is really inherent in here. I don't know. Is this what we might consider a dualistic worldview? Is that the problem of the sort of pendulum? Is that we're still seeing things as divided?
Well,
go ahead. Yeah, please.
Yeah, no. It's just it brings up you're talking about the anima mundi, and it's very relatable to mula prakriti. So they have in the processes of samadhi, when you reach higher states of quote unquote enlightenment, not liberation itself, but different levels of being able to perceive the material world. They say one of the biggest issues for the aspirant is when they get to the point of mula prakriti, where they see matter as undifferentiated, so that what were once opposites are no longer taken in opposition. There's a transcendence of sorts, but that one might not realize that one is still looking at the reflection, because the ecstasy that comes with the realization of matter being undifferentiated is ecstatic. And so when you reach different states of ecstasy, there's not as much of a pull to keep to turn around and keep focusing inward, to say neti neti, to still say not this at that, because it's so such an experience, right? So mula prakriti is mainly what it seems it's being spoken to, because that's the end of the pendulum. But at the same time, you're looking at the material, which still expresses itself as birth, growth, decay, and death, despite the fact that all of these are processes are seen as having distinctions but no separations, because what we emerge from, we go back into, and there's really no break in the sequence. And so you get what I'm getting at here. It's kind of interesting, because Purush, the spirit that's giving the thing, it's...
Sorry, would you relate this to the, you know, kind of what we do here, of like the joy and the undoubtedly the sort of excited, you know, we talk about making connections. The connections we make is sort of an exciting and stimulating, mentally stimulating thing to do. I don't think any one of us would doubt. It's almost like a, you know, in a sense, there is a sort of high that comes from it, for lack of a better term. Would you say that this is seeing things as undifferentiated and seeing the all, and that joy is kind of what you're talking about?
Yes, and I would say that it's not, that nothing that we're doing here is the aim. That the aim is primary to this. But what we're doing here, we could take infinitely further. You can keep going with it. And that's the thing. You could go your entire lifetime making connections, and there's no end to the connections that you can make looking at the material. But the material is still material, and that there's something that's before it that's not more substantial in the sense of substance, but it is more substantial in the sense that it's what's giving it its life. Because it has no life without the other thing, which doesn't stand out, you know. You look at nominal existence, and it's ecstatic to recognize the nominal side of things as opposed to phenomenal, but that's still not the essence. That's just the flip, the other, it's just peering deeper into the material and recognizing how everything's connected, which is necessary, but it's not what everything is what, it's not the ultimate aim of those practices.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Huh. I'm just sorry. So yeah, because like, I fixated on that for a moment, because it just coming back to that, like, make sure we're not doing something hypocritically foolish. You know, this, a lot of what we're kind of tiptoeing around is this idea of doing, you know, you think you're doing one thing, right? We talked about this idea of the sort of kephotic view of, like, you think it's something beneficial, you think you're evolving, and you're actually stepping away.
Right.
I'm just sort of throwing that possibility out there, or pondering.
This isn't the evolution. The evolution isn't just to see how everything's undifferentiated, but it's a necessary step, according to Patanjali. So, yeah.
Right, because it's, how does it change your perspective, and then how does it change your behavior? Because, again, if we're manifesting things, or if beyond mentally manifesting, again, you speak to the builder in us, you know, what are we building around us? And that goes for societies and everything else, because, you know, matter is, it's, it shouldn't be ignored as something irrelevant. I mean, our everyday lives, it's the matrix we live in. So what we build, how we build it, and then what motivates that, I think is important. So to, like, be exploring these ideas, okay, maybe, I mean, obviously we must be making mistakes here and there and not be getting the whole picture, but that's part of it. But I think that, you know, morality and everything isn't a completely subjective thing. I think there's some things we should be able to agree on that are right and wrong, in a sense of, does this help people, you know, develop themselves and lead a happy life or not? And so if you're pulling back information, or you're gleaning something from an experience, or even evaluating something like pop media, if that hints at something that that can help someone, you know, lead a better life, or at least, like, bring some satisfaction, where then they are able to build something better flowing from that inner peace or inner space or whatever, then there's value in it, and there's, like, a morality to it, and there's a good thing to it.
Right.
Where, because, I mean, like, we always identify what we're doing based on you know, the duality in the world. It's like we compare ourselves to other things, people, systems, and then it's like, okay, what's right in that and what's wrong in it? And we look at what we're enmeshed in like materialistic Western world. It's pretty, in a lot of ways, it's a soulless dead place. It's a lot, it's kind of like a zombie food court. It's not, it's, there isn't too much room for self-development, or if there's room for it, there's such a dense cloud surrounding people's like everyday lives and their everyday mindsets that there's not any, there's not much development. There's just kind of like a perpetuation of the machine. It's not growing the individual within it, even though we use a lot of propaganda about individuals and, you know, oh, be your own person, blah, blah, blah. I mean, all I see is conformity more often than not. And this isn't to be like self-righteous that I'm like special. I really hope I'm not coming off that way, because I'm a conformist and I'm very much in line with a lot of, I've been brainwashed in a lot of ways too. But I think just being able to recognize it, even if you're not able to completely absolve yourself of it, is kind of an important step.
Yeah. Yeah.
Joe, last time I spoke to you, you said you were working on a video. I know you're working on a video for the Olympia Sync Summit.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was going to be specifically of this idea of, I don't know if this is the video or this is the overall mindset you're in of the connection of Back to the Future and love. What, can you give me a hint of what's in this that you're doing?
Yeah. So, I know a lot of people in the Sync community might feel like this is a tired subject and they might just hate it altogether, but then I'm sure there's people who don't think this is tired and love it as much as they always did. But I am making a video that, not just in the sense of sync or mysticism, but in a really like logical sense, is trying to make the argument that the movie Back to the Future actually predicts the events of 9/11. So it's kind of like only half a sync or mysticism video. It's actually more of a conspiracy film. And I think that it'll be interesting in the sync community, because a lot of the evidence takes a certain amount of subscription to, you know, sync ideas and loose connections, but some of it doesn't. Some of it's pretty overt and obvious, even to people who might not like conspiracy videos. You know, there's people who don't like sync videos. There's people who don't like conspiracy videos, and then there's people who, you know, they just look at logical arguments and they can't say that that's wrong because it's obvious. And things like that exist in Back to the Future as it relates to 9/11. I've been kind of on this thread for a really, really long time, and I've wanted to make this particular video because it's, to me at this point, really obvious that this film, at least at a non-intentional level, at least, you know, at an energetic level, predicts the events of 9/11. So that's what this video is about.
Kent, do you mind if we talk a little about some of those details? Because, so, just to say, so here's something, like, when we talk about sync leading you to, like, kind of a, again, it's, like, such a hard way to phrase it, because you'd say, how literal do you want to take it? Like, a sort of confirming your thought process. You know, there's the 9/11 sort of, one of the conspiracies is that, like, you know, how were the buildings brought down? Was it, you know, directed energy? Was it nanothermite? And there's these people who talk about a mini nuke. Have you ever heard that conspiracy theory?
Oh, yeah, I have. There's a big Red Ice Radio thing about it.
Okay, so to me, the fact that 9/11 is so connected to all of the, as Will Morgan and I were having a conversation, he said it's not so much like, he said he doesn't like talking in terms of archetypal resonance, but more of symbol sets that all these symbols like to lump together. To me, it's basically the same thing, but I liked that wording and sort of distinction. And so it's like so these symbol sets. And to me, like, 9/11 is so in this conversation. It's the elephant in the room, in a sense, because it's the modern equivalent of what we're talking about. So without a doubt, I feel this is connected. But then the fact that we have this essentially atomic correlation and this Adam, you know, like it's the splitting, the 9/11 is the splitting of the Adam. It is the Shekinah. It is all these things. I sometimes wonder, does that mean the quote unquote mini nuke is like, is it just it's undoubtedly part of the symbol set. So if we're going to go literal, is that why it is raised as an option, even if it's not what actually brought them down, is that just its inclusion as one of the theories makes it part of the symbol set, or does that mean that it's literally in there? This is something I think about sometimes, but I'm just curious to hear some of your content, because I feel like, yeah, 9/11 is so in this. It's I'd love to take it in that direction.
I'll just throw out the most, obviously I don't want to just throw out everything as far as like the content of what I'm putting in this, because I want it to flow together so that people can experience it. Yeah. But I will say that there is a, man, this is just mind blowing. Okay. So you said that sync, you know, can lead to conclusions that one in the non-sync community would consider like the scientific method, where you form hypotheses and then you look for results and you can confirm them, you know, and they're repeatable. And that's kind of happened with Back to the Future with me with 9/11. It's like, you know, with Jake and 9/11 kind of being a big catalyst for the synchromysticism movement. I think everyone would agree that, you know, 9/11 is the elephant in the room, you know, in every conversation that we have.
It's the elephant that we talk about.
Yeah, yeah. And even though we talk about it, it's not talked about enough. Like it's the reason I'm in this community. It's probably the reason most of the people are. So anyways, it was just interesting for me personally, and anyone who's attracted to my Back to the Future thread, well, obviously not my thread, but my particular insights into it, that it would lead back to this area of 9/11, because to me, this is like the strongest, craziest shit with Back to the Future. There's actually a scene in Back to the Future that shows New York City. It shows Statue of Liberty and the twin fucking towers, and it shows the towers collapse in Back to the Future. And I've watched the fucking film, like, I don't know how many times I've watched this film. I really couldn't tell you. I watched this film endlessly, and I've never seen it before. And I finally saw it. It's in this film. It's insane. It shows the towers collapse.
That's crazy. Are we talking about, I know the Twin Towers are in the, when Back to the Future 2, where it's like on the video screen? Is that what we're talking about, or?
Yeah. So that's what we're talking about. So the towers come up on the screen, and it's amazing in its own right that the Twin Towers are present in this film. I think that, you know, you pointed that out to me initially. Was it you, Alan? Is that right?
I don't know.
Someone did. Anyways,
I'm not looking for credit. Yeah, everyone contributes. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah, it was on an interview or something on Skype. But anyways, so the towers are in this film, in that scene. It's like really obscured. I think you could watch the movie a million times and never see them, but they're there. And not only are the towers there, but there is a obvious intentional forming of Manhattan Island, because the fucking Statue of Liberty is also in that scene outside of the movie screen that shows the Twin Towers. So, you know, there's this obvious formation of Manhattan Island emerging in this living room scene. And if you watch this particular scene under certain conditions that I believe the director is leading you to watch it under, which is you're supposed to watch this scene upside down. And the reason that I know you're supposed to watch it upside down, I mean, I know this.
I'm muted, but I'm shouting. In my film,
I really want to, I'm working hard at this because I want to convey to the audience that watches my sync film that this is fucking real. You know, this isn't some bullshit that I've thrown together. This is fucking real. The director is telling the audience, watch this scene upside down. This is Manhattan Island. Here's the towers. Here's the Statue of Liberty, and watch it upside down. And there's a few clues that he gives, but I think that you shouting right now while you're muted is about the most obvious one, which is there's a fucking upside down human being, looming over this whole scene for no particular reason, just an inverted human who's observing all of this take place. And when you watch the Twin Towers on the screen, he is actually superimposing his body is superimposed over the screen upside down. It's like, you know, the director's like, look, watch this scene from this man's perspective. And that's not the only thing that's telling you to do this. There's a couple different indicators. You'll see him in my film, but that's the most glaring one. He's saying, look at this upside down. And if you watch this scene upside down from George McFly's perspective, you'll fucking watch it in slow motion. You'll see the Twin Towers fucking collapse at the moment Lorraine McFly says broken. It's fucking nuts.
So I got to tell you, Joe, I just watched a Polanski film from 1988 with Harrison Ford called Frantic. And I couldn't get over the fact that so it takes place in Paris. And he's actually staying at a building that's directly across from the French Statue of Liberty, right? Because the Statue of Liberty in New York was a gift from France, and there's actually two of them, right? And the film itself centers around a small Statue of Liberty that was in this woman's suitcase that contains a nuclear detonation device inside the statue. And the statue actually breaks in two, and that's how he ends up taking the device out. But as far as I could tell while watching it, it seemed like it was just – I was taking it just as a straightforward subliminal that this is his first film after everything. And he's not welcome in America, and the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of that everyone is welcome. Take your poor, take your hungry, or I forget what it actually is, but that's the idea, right? And so the point being that he's not receiving that same level of liberty, and people can – feel how they want to about that. I don't exactly know even how I feel about it. But I do find it interesting that you have, you know, Harrison Ford, working girl, you know, where I'm going with this. There's a scene where he wakes up and he's looking, and it just, all of a sudden, you're looking at the Statue of Liberty in France upside down. And then the camera literally turns, and then you're looking at it right side up as he's shifting his head around to get an angle, but he represents it. And I thought that was so interesting to show you. I just looked at it like an inverted symbol, you know, that it's like down with liberty, basically. But the fact that the Statue of Liberty contains the nuclear device and that this film came out in 1988, as far as sync is concerned, that's kind of and for what you're saying, it's kind of a relatable thing, huh?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's awesome. I'm going to have to... Yeah, we'll have to get together and watch these scenes. And yeah,
okay,
that's cool.
Okay,
man.
So this is... All right, here we go. All of New York needs to be viewed from upside down. Okay. Now here's the funny part. This is a realization I had while sitting on the toilet. All right. I don't know exactly how it all starts, but I have this idea. So I don't currently live in New York, but I did for 31 and a half or 32 years of my life. So born and raised there, I know New York inside and out, but I had this idea one day. I think after listening to one of Steve Wilner's podcasts, Cracks in the Wall podcast, where they're talking, he has this guy on who goes by the name Will777. And Will777 says something about, he's talking about the five corners of a pyramid, and that he says, you know, the pyramid is the formula for a Superman, and he's like, and he just he goes into this little thing, and I'm like, I don't know why it just sparked something in my mind of there are five boroughs of New York City. It's like what everyone knows, New York City, they think Manhattan, but it's actually made up of five little pieces, and Manhattan is only one of those pieces. So I started thinking, oh, these are the five points of a pyramid. New York is a pyramid. And I immediately assumed that, oh, Manhattan's going to be the top of the pyramid. That's why it's so famous, right?
Right.
But what I ended up doing is I pulled down a subway map, and I take it into the bathroom with me, and I'm just kind of looking at this thing as I'm sitting, you know, taking a shit. I'm kind of looking at this map. I'm like, how could this work? And I look at it for a while, and then I kind of put the map down on the floor or whatever I do. I kind of like, all right, I'm done looking at this. And I kind of put it down. And the way, I guess when I turned it away from me, now it's upside down. And as I'm sitting in the toilet and I'm kind of not looking at it, and then when I look back at it, now the map is upside down, and suddenly it clicks. You're supposed to look at it upside down. So all our maps are oriented, north is at the top, but there is what we call Brooklyn is Kings County, and then there's Queens County. If on a north-facing normal map, it goes Queens on top, Brooklyn beneath it, like, you know, south of it. But in a pyramid, we would have the King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber. So it's Kings County, Queens County. Oh, right. These are the chambers of a pyramid.
Right.
Now, they're like the Bronx, which is the northmost thing, is going to be, the Bronx, which is the northmost, the top part of the map, but in like the slang of how people refer to the Bronx, I mean, not really anymore, but used to be the boogie down Bronx. And it's like, oh, of course, because it's at the bottom. It's the down. It's down. And Staten Island, the fifth borough besides Manhattan, it's called Staten Island, just how Brooklyn isn't really called Brooklyn. It's called Kings County. Staten Island is called Richmond County. And what did I say? The meaning of Pluto was, of course, is Mound of Riches.
Right, which is the god of the underworld, right?
Right, right, right. So you could say that that's also the under, but it's the mound. It's the high mound. This is the apex of the pyramid.
Perfect.
So it just like it was this like realization, and once I turned the whole map upside down, like just epiphany after epiphany after epiphany came to me that all my life I'm looking at a north-facing map of New York when actually you have to turn the fucking thing upside down.
You know, Alan, that's really weird because that's how I was relating to like Emerald City Undercover when you look at the NY and the OZ, and if you lay the alphabet, it's because of the bottom alphabet. It's putting the alphabet below the alphabet that you end up with recognizing that correspondence. I looked at like Oz as like the underworld flip side or whatever, the mirror representation in a sense of New York is Oz. And that's why somewhere over the rainbow in the same way, like I find the symbolism of Wizard of Oz very relatable to Back to the Future in the sense that literally what he's doing in order to go back in time and to go back to the future is kind of it's incorporating this idea of transcending the seven lower spherot and then returning at a different place or on a different tree. Kind of strange, huh? Do you follow that?
Like the fact that it's the removal. You're looking at its twin tower. You're looking at two different alphabet structures shifting.
Right. Right, like how he runs over one of the pines, where you have the twin pines, and then the twin becomes a singular pine, right? It's kind of, I mean, it's kind of a hard thing to communicate. But yeah, symbolically, there's definitely something to that. Where it's like you're looking at the world through right and left brain, which crisscross to the eyes, and that the meaning of Horus, right, is that you're looking through one. You're what would be two things that are intertwined, you're basically just taking it from one side in order to understand the other so that they're not enmeshed. You can get an angle of awareness, right?
Why are you relating that to Horus?
Well, isn't that the idea that Horus is a singular eye?
Okay, yes. So, because in my mind, all right, Staten Island, this Richmond County, that is Horus. Richmond, Staten Island is Horus. And I don't go too crazy here to explain that, but to say, within weeks of me making this whole theory of, oh, this is blah, 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 New York City announced, and I have this little document on my blog, but within weeks of me, maybe days of me saying, oh, I figured it out, Richmond County is Horus, and blah, 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 New York City announced they are building a reconstruction of the London Eye, you know, that big Ferris wheel in London, the London
yes.
Eye. They are creating a replica of that and putting it on Staten Island. So I'm like, oh, this is Horus. This is blah, blah, blah. Oh, Horus is single eye. And then it's like, we've just announced we're going to put a fucking the eye. Like, it just makes no sense. It just makes this... I don't know.
Yeah, like beyond the synchronicity, what the fuck?
Exactly. Thank you. Yes. Yes, because the synchronicity is pretty powerful, and at the same time, wait, why are you doing that exactly?
Right. Right, because it has to, I mean, it's a symbolic thing. The eye is a symbolic thing for, you know, for the London Eye. Like, there has to be a meaning, and yet... Unless there's something I don't know about, I mean, I haven't looked into it too deeply, but what do they say the meaning is? Like, what are they trying to communicate other than what we're talking about? Like,
well, I think it's that when you go up in the eye, you can see the city. So it's like the London Eye, like, see the city.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Of course, I could be wrong.
Right. Well, it's a very strange deal in the first place, the way that they've erected that. It's a very weird kind of structure. It's very artistic, I guess you could say, you know. It's not like they just built something that will raise you up. It's like this fucking phenomenal looking deal. I don't know. Kind of strange.
Is that it? Do we burn out?
I mean, I'm processing right now.
Yeah, so no, it's okay. I don't mind silence.
I'm just over here thinking about Roger Rabbit, in Back to the Future, and we've discussed that a number of times. It's just that was one of those things. Like, you know, I got into Kevin Halcott's whole down the rabbit hole deal, and there's a few points where I just like my head literally like tilted completely sideways when I was like, wait a minute. Because, I mean, I'm following along, and he's going into Jim Carrey, and then he has the Star Sirius fall down, and there's the dog, the Dalmatian, and whatever, and then it's like, it says Sirius on the fucking thing, and I had like this like kind of like epiphany of like, oh my god, there's really something to this. That is mysterious. Like, Jesus Christ. And so... You know, that Roger Rabbit, that the voice of Roger Rabbit is the guy who tells him about the clock tower, if I'm not mistaken, Joe?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and then Roger Rabbit shows up in the Blast from the Past window, and it's a white rabbit, you know, and just it's just so clever. And it's embedded in the thing, and it's subtle, but it's not too subtle, you know? Like, if you put that together, it's like it's got some meaning, and so... Yeah, it's weird.
Hmm. Yeah, I wanted. Oh, sorry.
Please, Joe.
No, I wanted to note that we had talked previously about the theme in Back to the Future about driving into movie screens and the movie screen as the monolith, and that the transcendence is associated with peering at the screen, absorbing information on the surface level, or, you know, whatever information it can be absorbed through movies and media. So, you know, we talked about how in Back to the Future, he drives into the movie theater. He also drives into the photo booth. In part three, he drives into the drive-through movie screen outside. So it's a pretty prevalent theme. So, you know, we're journeying down the rabbit hole going through the movie screen. But then when he sees the Roger Rabbit bunny in the window, the one David's talking about, I always thought it was cool that the rabbit was sitting on top of the TV in the window. You know, like he's the rabbit ears of the TV, like go down the rabbit hole, go down the TV, look into the screen. So the Roger Rabbit, white rabbit in the film Back to the Future was literally the bunny ears of a TV. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just had my mind blown watching. I haven't seen the last episode of Mad Men, but I watched the rest of them. And I don't know if you guys are following Mad Men. I know, Alan, you're not. But do you guys watch Mad Men?
I do not.
Okay, so one of the last episodes was called The Monolith. And in that episode, there's overt symbolism relating to 2001. A giant computer, the IBM computer, is introduced into, you know, the public relations facility, right? Because it's an advertising space. And I'm going to do a spoiler, and y'all can just deal with that because it's so applicable, I can't mention it. The man is watching, reading people's lips, and he thinks that there's a homosexual thing going on between his bosses, and he's tripping out. And he cuts his nipple off, and he gives it to Peggy, one of the women working there. And I immediately, you know, I'm just thinking, what is the first thing you see in 2001 A Space Odyssey that we've related to as when you're looking at a planetary alignment from the dark side of the moon, right? And you see that you could take that as a nipple. It's just a weird connection that we made quite a while ago. And we made a point of it at the time, as weird as it sounds. But yeah, I equate the beginning of 2001 with a nipple. And I think Milky Way, and I think the old Malaco Plus, and the beginning of Clockwork Orange, where he's sipping on the milk and it's supposed to be a mother's breast, and that's the whole deal, you know. Very strange, you know, and I go to Titus Caesar in my own mind, and there's reasons for that that are rather complex, but, and I'm insane, I'm sure, but, you know, it was just one of those things where it was just very, very overt in the show that it's like, how random is that? And it was another example of, without the synchronicity, what the fuck does that mean? Why cut off a nipple in response to 2001? And I guess the joke was is that all these people went to go see 2001 A Space Odyssey on heroic doses of acid, and that the guy probably just, that's what they're trying to communicate, is that this guy went crazy by going to see 2001 on acid, and that was his response, was to cut his nipple off and hand it to somebody in a little box. But... it's that line, and the joke being that where is the line between what you're viewing and what your experience is in the world? Because you start out watching that film and you're literally looking at a projector pointed at you, you know, as the sun. And then there's a large breast, apparently, in between you and that. And it's relatable for me to Gomer Pyle, who basically, the joke being is that it's like the Oedipal idea, where he can't get beyond a certain stage of development in Freudian terms. He's kind of stuck in his evolution. And that when you're watching 2001 and you start out, you're looking at the monolith and you see this shape. If you look at the screen, it's the monolith. And it's like... you know, you're looking at the monolith as the touchstone of evolution. And so if we're stuck in a certain stage of development, if you take a single person's lifespan and then you project that onto the macrocosm of all of humanity's lifespan, and that we're kind of like, we made it to this certain stage and we can't seem to get beyond the other level because we can't tilt our head far enough, you know, yeah, it's kind of some trippy thoughts, but that's what the show is for, I guess.
Cool.
Yeah, might be a conversation stopper, especially if you guys aren't familiar with Mad Men, but it's still worth saying.
No, I definitely think the opening shot of 2001: A Space Odyssey is a nipple. When we first started the Mask of God blog, it was like, I think one of the first things I had done was took a screenshot of that, found a picture online of a woman weighing on her back, like a bare-breasted woman weighing on her back, superimposed them and said, "You see?" And I was like, "It's so queer. It's just so queer that that's what that is." That's my projection onto it. Maybe I just like.
You're looking at a projection.
Right, exactly.
And it also brings us back to grotesque sexual practices with regards to a nipple shot, you know.
A nipple, yeah.
Or shooting onto a nipple.
Good one.
Thanks.
You catch the sinks that are like thing in Berkeley, man. It was like you're good at those kind of ones. I miss those, you know. They're like wordplay and things that are hiding in plain sight. That's a good one.
Thanks.
All right. Well, I'm really excited to see your video, Joe. I'm looking forward to your next installment.
Thanks, man.
I appreciate going into levels of conspiracy and mixing it around, or at least presenting things as possibilities. And if that's where it leads you, then that's where it fucking leads you. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, fuck it.
It's like, I've just gotten to a breaking point with certain synchronicities where I'm like, I can't pretend anymore that in the direction I lean. So I'm not making any absolute statements, but there comes a certain point where you're just like, oh, come on, give me a break. And it starts to feel like you're acting or something if you're pretending that you don't lean in the direction of a conspiratorial type deal, you know. Like if you feel like someone arranged something, if you connect names and people and they're with each other and stuff, it's just it reaches a breaking point sometimes. And so if you think that it's in the direction of a conspiracy, then fucking come out with it, you know. Don't just
totally
stick with the synchromysticism, you know. Kind of like safeguard, you know.
Absolutely, and I feel the same way. Like, I mean, that's it's really important. Like, I'm with Suicide Kings. I'm really trying to do something similar, and it's like, it's not because there shouldn't be like any kind of blowback from that from anybody. Anybody who wants to give you blowback of that, they will fuck themselves first off. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, some people don't care to make the distinction. I do. There are things that I see that I think are synchronicities, and there are things that I see that I think are intentional. I would like to say, hey, and there are things that I don't know. And I want to be able to say, I think this is this, and this is this, and this is this. I could be wrong, of course, but this I think is intentional, this I don't, this I think is sync, this. And then when you want to zoom out, you go, of course, it's all both and all of the above at the same time, right? Because it's layers upon layers upon layers. Yes, this guy intentionally planned this, and yet the universe planned this, and yet George Bush planned this, and yet etc., etc., etc. So it's all like part of the cosmic play, but to say I think someone planned this, please, like, don't ever... I don't like the sort of the crowd sometimes that like wants to really distance themselves from that so much because, you know, they're just afraid of saying,
yeah, having to like tiptoe around shit, you know. It's like, why can't you say what you think, you know? Not that you believe, but it's just like, hey, I've, you know, it seems like this to me, like,
yeah.
Robert Anton Wilson, it's like, it appears like this to me. I'm not saying it is. It appears like that, and why can't I even bring it up, or why can't we have a conversation?
Yeah,
people are just like so aggressive about their point of view that they just—it's so weird.
Yeah, I have more and more sympathy for Subliminal Synchrosphere with some of the things that he stumbled upon. Of course, he fucking feels that way, And there's no reason why he shouldn't be able to express that he feels that way and have to tiptoe around it. I think he's going to be pleasantly surprised if he has a conversation with us, which I hope he will soon, to find how sympathetic we are with his feeling around it, you know? Yeah. A friend of mine posted the other day, I think it may have been yesterday or the day before, but I responded to it yesterday, Scott Onstott, Secret in Plain Sight, and somebody's over there making comments about, like, oh, it's math, it must be a fucking conspiracy and this and that. And it's like, have you heard Scott Onstott's statements around it? Because I even, like, afterwards, I re-listened to the show just because we get really hung up on that distinction sometimes. But we're also feeling out our guests and seeing where they're coming from with the material and getting the idea of how they're interpreting it. Because I've watched his presentation, and a lot of people have watched it, and he doesn't seem to lean in any direction in the presentation itself. So I was excited to have a conversation with the guy and see where he stands. And I was pleasantly surprised with where he stands, which is he doesn't fucking know. But he's open to all kinds of possibilities. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's amazing that people are reacting before they even know where someone's coming from. You know, it's pretty incredible.
Like, yeah, the animal instinct to gravitate towards like an orthodoxy that you need to settle on something. And then you have to almost like attack other people to get people in line. We're just such pack animals. It's really emblematic of like how primate-esque we are.
Yeah. I mean, in a certain way, I feel like it's kind of ridiculous how much we have the same conversation around intentionality and spontaneous alignments. But then again, it's like, people continue to make the to have this kind of black and white thinking around it, so we have to keep fucking talking about it. Like, right. You know, it's like it kind of puts us in a weird position because we're like, we can't not address it when people are perpetually addressing it. Like, and maybe it's like a knot that needs to be worked out or something, you know. And all we're doing is kind of a metaphysical massage or something, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, right. I think what really the real cure for it is just not talk to assholes about it. I mean,
that's what I'm trying to. Yeah, I'm just trying. I'm starting to avoid certain people. Maybe that's not healthy to avoid people, but like I find myself like in certain discussions and stuff. It's just like I don't even want to have that anymore because I'm like I'm beyond it. And if you can't see that, then I can't spend all day trying to convince you of it. It's just too exhausting.
Right. To tell me, but at the same time, I don't close myself off. I can turn into a good conversation. As somebody coming from an angle, you know, and
right.
Like people sometimes that have a very different angle, but yet we're still able to meet. And we've right. had a lot of people on the show that are coming from a completely different place, but we still communicate, you know. But yeah, there can be a breaking point sometimes when you're dealing with, you know, certain kinds of belief systems and whatnot that are, rather than open belief systems, they're closed belief systems. And so that can be a challenge. And sometimes you're just like, okay, I give up, you know. But it's not even about convincing somebody of your perception a lot of times as much as it is just getting them to consider another possibility or being open to that, you know. It's like
or to not misunderstand what you're saying, because everyone just, man, you know, David Bohm was hit the nail on the head. He's just like, people hear what they want to hear and fill in the gaps from their subconscious. So it's like, oh, you say this one trigger word, and so that stirs up these emotions, and then that paints my entire perspective of everything you're saying. And so I don't even have to read really closely what you're saying, because I'm just starting to make up my mind really quickly on a knee-jerk kind of emotional reaction. And it's not just Bohm that said that. I mean, that's just basic psychology, but it's so amazing how little that's explored or at least talked about. It just happens all the time, and it's fucking exhausting.
yeah
it's funny too how Sync like sidesteps those trigger words, like sometimes putting things in the context of this is unintentional allows us to sidestep that notion of conspiracy and like the stigma that's attached to it.
But yeah,
with some people who love conspiracy, putting it in the context of this is unintentional rubs them the wrong way. So,
yeah.
Getting into like 9/11, I can't tell you how many fucking times at like the coffee shop, I'll state that I'm not a 9/11 truther. I don't know what the truth of the situation is. I know that there's some weird surrounding it that I can't explain, including finding reference apparently in the Zohar and things that I could go into, you know, but like, it's like, they're like, oh, come on, George Bush, he's an idiot. I'm like, what? What does George Bush have to do with fucking any of this? Like, of course he's not clued into what's going on. Look at his face. You can tell. Oh, you're talking about like rogue aspects of government, and we don't even know who's behind what. We don't know any of this. So, yeah. God. Yeah, it really works. Like, you can see what a perfect manipulation it is to put such a, it's a wise man to play the part of a fool. It doesn't even have to be a wise man to put someone else is wise to put the fool in there, you know. He's not wise to play the part of a fool. He's got wise people, or at least somewhat intelligent people, placing a fool there, you know, because he doesn't look like he knows what's going on. How perfect is that, you know?
Yeah, and no matter like where you draw the line about who's quote unquote ruling the world or this and that, I mean, you can't help but marvel at how well people at the top manage perception. There's a stupidity and a hubris and a total one, they're just, in a lot of ways, they're morons, but on another way, they're just like so good at manipulating. It's really quite impressive. So just like on an intellectual level, you can't be help but be impressed, but also, you know, sickened on another level. So,
Joe, it was actually Joe who said something to me a while back. I think this might've been our first conversation show. You said something like, it's good, even from a quote-unquote sink perspective, conspiracy is really healthy because it makes people, it shakes people out of their worldview. It's like, to me, this is almost the definition of what a psychedelic experience is. I was thinking like recently, like, so I grew up in New York. I'm not one, I never owned a car. I never had a driver's license till just recently. So the whole driving thing is new for me. And it's like, whenever time I'm driving, I'm thinking this is a psychedelic experience because it's a completely different frame of mind, right? Like your mind is operating differently. And I assume maybe if you're playing a sport, you know, in the zone, it's like your mind shifts into a different way of thinking. And we get so bogged down in the standard American brainwashed whatever, just day-to-day materialist going through the motions, that anything that can kind of make you realize that you can change perceptions, that there are different reality tunnels, is super healthy. And so even from that perspective, I think conspiracy, and this was Joe, this was something you said to me, and just really has stuck with me, that like, yeah, to whether or not you're going to, you know, go to a, you know, start a campaign to get Dick Cheney thrown in jail, or start, you know, going out as a 9/11 truther, these are potential roads that this can take you down, but it can also just open your mind to, oh, the world is not as I've always thought it was.
Yeah, they're just kind of like stops along the way, and it's part of like uncovering like the narrative, I guess. Neil Kramer calls them gates of awakening, where you like stumble across certain gates, but then you might stay just like totally trapped in a loop, and so you never progress. So there's an endless progression, but it's all a matter of like if you choose to move beyond it or not. So someone realizes, okay, everything's corrupt in politics, okay, and then that might lead you to conspiracy. Well, and then does that lead you to synchronicity? And then where does synchronicity lead? Because I think then that could also be a trap too. It's all a matter of balancing stuff.
Oh yeah, I eagerly await the thing beyond this. You know, not because this is awesome, but at the same time, yeah, it's like you should always, to a certain extent, always be open to the next awakening, if you will.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it's like, honestly, I think it's like, it's death. It's it's nothing that anybody wants to talk about, but I think, like, confronting death and, like, really learning about the dynamics of death is really that next step. If, like, Joe, you mentioned, like, it seems to be the human habit to want to transcend and to move beyond like our limitations and what have you. is there not a greater limitation or a greater, like, you know, taboo or fear than death? It's like, it's the ultimate. And so it's like, what is that? And what does it reveal about us, and what, where does it lead? And so I'm still kind of, I always got into this stuff because of, like, I was always had an interest in hauntings. And so I guess everything for me started with death. And I don't go back to it too often, but it's always like in the back of my mind.
Hmm. Yeah,
and that's why
that's the root of all the other fears, right? Because if it wasn't for that fear, none of the other fears would have any significance whatsoever. Yeah,
I mean, it's definitely what fuels, like, you know, all the fucking empire building. It's just like, I need to create a permanency in this world because I know that I have a clock on my head.
Right.
And so, like, what am I willing to do to create a timelessness for myself? Because I don't think that I'm actually timeless. But I think that, I don't know, from what I've investigated into, it's like, I think there's a timelessness to consciousness. I don't think death is necessarily the end. It's not like, fucking God on his golden throne is waiting to let you into heaven through his gates or anything, it's a different level of reality. And I think, like, near death experience and past life stuff. And I think that strongly hints at that, you know, the brain itself. Day to day, it's just like your classical Newtonian machine. But when you push it to the extremes, just like you do in general relativity, when you push the laws of Newtonian physics to the extremes of speed of light or whatever, they break down, right? And the same thing with human consciousness. When you push it to the extremes, like on the precipice of death, it all of a sudden reveals what it really is. And it's something much deeper, in the same way that relativity, like, unveils something deeper.
Right.
So that's how I view it.
Yeah, it's the purpose of yoga to die before you die, right? I mean, I find it paradoxically interesting that if you look at the Carl Jung's Red Book, I mean, it's a confrontation with the subconscious that's literally having to do everything with the underworld, and he goes into the golden bough and all this kind of stuff. But then its aim is actually individuation, or maybe not necessarily its stated aim. I mean, it is its stated aim intentionally, but at the same time, it's a byproduct of that work. Is individuation, which isn't to project a, you know, an archetype and then try and, like, become that archetype. That's not individuation. That's something else. And that's what advertisers use. And that's what films use. And that's what all these things kind of play on, is our desire to do that, which is actually aversion to embodying who we actually are. And whatever context it is that you're born into, that's what you're left to reconcile, or that's what you're left to transform, or transmute. But I find that focus of psychoanalysis, that its aim is individuation, which isn't a matter which you have to non-localize yourself in order to discover what your individual actually entails as a dynamic, unique structure, you know. Despite the fact that there's certain underlying principles that are not unique at all, it's like what we're focused on as presenting as unique is not unique in the slightest, because we have an aversion to actually discovering what is actually unique about ourselves, you know, because that's responsibility.
Yeah, it's a fear thing. It's like, because again, if you really discovered a truth about yourself, that it's like, hey, I have a lot more responsibility than I thought I did as a person or a human being or whatever. It's like, people are afraid of that responsibility. It's like, it's almost too much to take. And so, you know, I bring up Alan Moore a lot, but that was, like, a very wise thing he said in that documentary, where he's like, you know, if you discover your higher self, then you have a responsibility to that higher self. And it's like, most of us can't even handle our responsibilities on a day-to-day level. And I know, like, that's my case, and that's my case for a lot of people. It's like, life is hard enough. Whereas then you enter into this whole kind of, like, cosmic responsibility stuff, and it's like, oh my fucking God, it's like, I have a hard time waking up in the morning, let alone dealing with this shit. But I think,
right, it's really important. You're already, like, it's kind of a hard thing to explain, but that was Krishnamurti's focus when he's talking about how people are afraid of what will happen if they let go of what it is that they're doing, but they're not recognizing that what they should be more afraid of is what they're already doing, not what will happen when you step into the unknown. The unknown isn't the thing to fear. The thing to fear is actually the known, because you can see its results and what it's doing. So it's like,
right,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, look at the world around us and what we create, right, by our, like, day-to-day actions, even, like, it, even with altruism and people's impulse to do good. It's like, you know, something is way off in the world and the way people are approaching problems and approaching our larger goals. And I think that's part of it. It's just like the proof is in the fucking pudding. It's everywhere. It's just look at society. Look at the world. It's a fucking mess in a lot of ways. And yes, it's chaos and stuff. There's beauty in the chaos and there's a creative aspect to it. And I do think that it's moving towards something better, but you know, you can't help but say it doesn't have to necessarily be this painful. But maybe it does. I don't know. Who the hell knows?
Yeah. Well, the thing, you know, Joe, when you talk about if you believe something and, you know, it's that belief that something's possible, even if it's unprecedented, it's the belief that makes it possible. I mean, I can see your attraction towards that idea because in order for you to do what it is that you're doing, I don't know how else you could possibly do it. I mean, it's like, look at you and what you do and, you know, you're reaching feats, you're presenting challenges, you're having challenges presented and you're meeting those challenges to the best that you're able. But I could imagine how being a basketball player like you are, you get to places where you watch yourself do something in retrospect that you don't even know how maybe you did it, right?
Yeah, actually, the like overall process of even getting to the level where I could play at the level that I wanted to was totally predicated on believing in something that really is not possible. You know, so exercising that ability to believe in something that there's no evidence for was really the only way that this was able to happen. And that is why I subscribe to this idea that, you know, you manifest things regardless of how plausible they should be. You manifest them completely based on the fact that you either believe them or you don't. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah. I've watched, you know, Michael Jordan fly through the air and make a slam dunk, and it's unreal. Like, it is really unreal. It looks like it's defying fucking physics.
Yeah.
I remember in the day watching that and just being like, it's like the first time I saw elk. And I had no basis for comparison, a huge fucking elk, you know, and I'm just like, I had to reconfigure my mind to allow in this new thing that I'm looking at. I'm like, what? I mean, that happens to be an experiential example where I had to readjust my paradigm in order to let in something new. And it sounds like it should be easy, but it wasn't actually easy. It actually took me a few moments to like register what I was looking at.
In the pines, waiting for us around the bend. Picture in your mind, love forever. But till then, is she clear?